Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday. Wow, I almost said February, what? November 17th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in, no longer the literal, never in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the part of the opening that we haven't written yet, in booming downtown Brooklyn, home of Shirley Chisholm and the Notorious B.I.G. It's the best I could give you. I love both of those people. On today's program, Matt and I are holding it down. We're breaking down the news for you.
Sam's feeling a little bit ill.
Sam is getting over his cold. Really sick. I talked to Sam this morning, and he sounded like his voice sounds like one of those amplifiers that kidnappers use to scramble their voices in the movies. I don't know if people know what I'm talking about, but he's pretty bad. So it's a good opportunity for him to rest up. Don't worry, we got you covered. Obviously, going to be checking in on the latest from what's happening in ISIS, the Middle East. Another beheading of an American aid worker. Also, another problem that comes out of Republicans taking over Congress. Another way to undermine a potential deal with Iran, which could be not only a great accomplishment of the Obama administration, but actually produce a more stable world. Al Franken schools Ted Cruz on net neutrality. I'm sure that Ted Cruz will respond rationally to everything Al Franken said. And we got a whole lot more. What else we got, man?
We got a ton of stuff. I mean, we're gonna play some horrible Rush Limbaugh audio. Just, jeez, the guy just doesn't... There's nothing this guy won't touch, is there?
No.
In a horrific way, I'm talking about.
He has the... whatever the... opposite of the Midas touches.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's got tons more. We'll get.
Yeah,
to
we
more.
Got a lot, and we would love. Well, the IMs are open on the fun half, so we'll take your IMs.
Oh, no, the IMs are open and now.
Excuse me. You're right. The
you
IMs are open
IM
now.
You can call into this show.
You can call
now,
in the show
646-257-3920. We're taking calls and IMs throughout the whole show, not just the members' better half portion of the show.
Yeah, so this is a good time. I know sometimes both when we host and when Sam hosts, so many calls come in, we can't get to all of them. We'll certainly get to all of them today. So call.
It's going to be like 100 calls. We're like, we lied. We can't get to them all. It's too many.
If there are 100 calls, I will go 10 minutes extra. all right, let's get to this really briefly. Over the weekend, Peter Kasich, who was an American aid worker, was beheaded by ISIS. They released a video along with a statement by their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The specifics of this beheading, I just want to touch on this for a moment, are really – this was a guy who even other groups, even one affiliate – even there was even a statement from al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, saying to – basically asking ISIS to spare this guy. He had established a reputation as a just sort of unimpeachable for his aid work, that even al-Qaeda affiliates were saying – that he should be left alone. I think ISIS, by not releasing, apparently they didn't release, or it hasn't been released yet, the full killing. So in other words, they released up to the moment of the beheading. That may have been their sort of tip of the hat to people who are asking to spare him. But in any event, they have murdered this guy. There's more on the way. Apparently, they have a woman hostage as well. So the strategy that they've pursued from the beginning, they're continuing, which is really using social media and these horrific videos to kind of create a global presence and really also to terrify the people in the areas they are operating in. I mean, that's a very important aspect of this whole situation, how they're kind of operating through fear in Syria and Iraq, even in places they have no control over. You know, a couple of weeks ago when we played that video from Kurdish television of the Kurdish comedians mocking ISIS, that really was not only funny and kind of, you know, impressive to find humor in a situation like that. It's unbelievably courageous because, you know, if there's anything a group like ISIS loathes, obviously, it's any type of mockery or humor in general. And they've really been working to kind of spread fear and demobilize all of the sort of populations and places they operate. And, you know, some people, there's very different feelings about how our campaign is going in the Middle East. First of all, it's kind of amazing that, you know, we are back at war in Syria and Iraq. General Dempsey, head of the United States Armed Forces, said a couple of days ago that he wouldn't rule out sending ground troops back to Iraq if the Iraqi army doesn't succeed after all of their training. I think the idea that we're basically saying our troops not going in is based on the performance of Iraq's army would give you a pretty good indication that troops going back into Iraq aren't that far off. So, you know, and it's just sort of disappeared from the headlines. But really, you know, we've been engaged in intensive aerial bombing for several weeks now and finally providing a little bit more support for the Kurds. We know that, you know, the Kurds are able to push ISIS out of Kobane. That was a great achievement. We know that we have struck at certain ISIS facilities. We know that we've sort of disrupted some of their supply routes, some of their money-making mechanisms. We also certainly know that we've killed a lot of civilians, even though that's not being tracked. And we know really that the divisions that ISIS had, as an example, with Al-Qaeda affiliates apparently are closing. And that ISIS is really, at the same time that it's retreating from our aerial campaign, is consolidating its grip and its position as the sort of global jihad player across the region and now more formally globally. Because there was a recent statement that was released by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who calls himself the caliph of the Islamic State. He released an audio message saying, quote, he called upon his soldiers to erupt volcanoes of jihad everywhere. He called the United States terrified, weak, and powerless, and that the U.S. is unable to send ground forces to fight the Mujahideen. And he's received pledges of loyalty from the Al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen, other people, other operatives and organizations in Egypt and Libya, and really elsewhere throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And I guess the kind of final point to close on this is, you know, we just see the same dynamic playing out again. And I think I've been really clear that in a situation that is a humanitarian emergency that does pose some sort of greater threats of destabilization to the Middle East, I think backing the Kurds is totally essential. I think when we use limited air power to save the Yazidis that were literally going to be basically the victims of a genocide, essentially, from ISIS, I think that was appropriate. But this whole thing that we've done with no real strategy, no real plan, other than to again reinsert ourselves without any long-term planning and without any broader sense of how to actually heal these divisions, how to actually address the underlying problems, we're recreating all of the same dynamics. And part of it, too, is, you know, you got to also go back really briefly to Egypt. I mean, Egypt has gone out of the headlines, but it is a core part of understanding everything that's going on in that region. When the uprisings took down Mubarak several years ago, it was the sort of pinnacle moment of the movements that swept across the Middle East in 2011. And, you know, that led to elections and it led to some reform. The Muslim Brotherhood came to power. And it's really clear that they did not do a good job with power, okay? They totally were going – they did not have a commitment to the mechanisms of democracy beyond winning elections. And they were governing in a really problematic way. No doubt about it. I'm not an apologist for the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But that said, this is an organization that had gone from the underground and gone from the margins and now was participating as the democratically elected leadership of Egypt. They obviously maintained relations with Israel. They didn't do anything fundamentally disruptive. But they were not performing on the economy and they were threatening some of the social openness of Egypt. Then you have a military coup, which, let's be honest, a lot of people in the West were really happy about. And what has that led to? It's led to the same dynamic where the Muslim Brotherhood is now again banned and outlawed. And that includes, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are not terrorists. They're Muslim conservatives. They're Muslim politicians. I disagree with their politics. I'm sure almost everybody listening disagrees with their politics. But they were in the process. And now they're back to being totally terrorized by the Egyptian state. And the lesson for some of them are going to die. Some of them might leave politics. Some of them might try to reform themselves and get inside the current system. But there's a reason why there's going to be an increase in terrorist activity on the Sinai. And there's a reason why ISIS is a kind of outlet for people where all these other venues for change have been closed. And, you know, and that doesn't excuse it. ISIS is absolutely appalling and abominable. And there's a lot of other reasons behind it. There's an ideology there that's sick. There's funding sources there that are a major problem. But we have collectively not supported democratic movements, preserving democratic process, and a number of other ways and outlets for people to actually potentially do something different in that region. And that all hasn't gone away, but now it's all blowing up in our faces. All of the same systems that held the status quo in place are crumbling, and that doesn't mean they're going to be replaced with something better. That's really obvious. So that's the state of things with ISIS, and that's the state of things with our air campaign there. Do one other Middle East story. Real quick. Wi-Fi beams. Alex Jones' net neutrality bit might be the best video since the Majority Report began. And no, transphobic Joe Rogan's impression is not even close to Sam. I didn't know Joe Rogan was transphobic. And I didn't know he did an Alex Jones impression. But I will say, no doubt, Sam has the best Alex Jones impression on the block. And that's hard for me to say because I usually don't really like Sam's impressions.
Is that Imer's screen name, Wi-Fi beams?
Yes.
That's great. That's from the video.
Oh, right. You know what?
That's from the Alex Jones video that
good,
we did.
Good call. I completely missed
that. Wi-Fi beams. You see, you got to get the Infowars.com Wi-Fi blocker.
What was it that he said? Oh, yeah. It's made from herbs. I always try to remember how he said it.
Herbs from the Amazonian rainforest where they can't get the fiber in.
Right.
So because they can't wire the fiber, the herbs there are untouched by Wi-Fi, meaning that it just naturally blocks it.
So I think Alex Jones is your best impression.
But it's not as good as Sam's.
No, Sam does. Sam, George W. Bush and Alex Jones, like, are Sam's. They're his, you know, those are his Da Vinci moments as an impressionist. He really... Alex Jones, he just nails.
Rush Limbaugh.
I think you sell Rush Limbaugh a little too hard. I think you got to. I mean, Rush isn't always in that, but, you know, it's good. Alex Jones and Rush. Those are your.
I just enjoy doing the thing he does when he goes.
Does he actually do that?
When he like really starts yelling, he does like, I guess he starts moving his body around and it just makes that sound.
Wow. That's pretty terrifying. Why don't you tell people the number again, and then I'll get to this next.
646-257-3920. That number is 646-257-3920. It's 12:30 in the afternoon on the East Coast, meaning I'm sure many of you were taking your lunch break. Call into the show.
Lunch breaks. People still even get lunch breaks anymore.
Yeah.
I
guess they do.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
Okay, so
that'd be sad if they didn't.
I feel like there, it's just the pace of everything is just so much faster. Yeah, the demands are so constant.
I'm sure there are many places
that, like, the idea of like having a lunch break seems like totally like not something that people in
I'm sure you have your 10-minute span in which you can run out, grab some food to bring back to the office.
I'm sure you have 10 minutes to grab a wrap and be like, I think you've misunderstood Gamergate, or you're being really unfair to Sam Harris. So let's get to this other story really quick. So it's out of the news a bit, but we all remember that in 2013 there was a sort of breakthrough agreement between Iran and the G5 plus one that they were meeting in Geneva at the time. And that basically an agreement that would, in exchange essentially for relaxing sanctions on Iran, Iran would agree to greater oversight on its nuclear program. And this happened in conjunction with a lot of things. New president of Iran really sort of, you know, rebranding Iran in a different way. Rouhani going on NBC and speaking to Ann Curry and talking about how in international relations we need to focus less on problems and things we don't want to see happen and more on optimal scenarios. Excuse me, P5 plus one. That's right. So the P5 plus one, so the interim agreement was established. There was an extension based on negotiations this past spring, and they're meeting again in this week to continue negotiations on Iran's program and on, of course, relaxing sanctions. And, you know, the big issue here is the actual mechanics of this deal are not that hard. For one, there's never been anything remotely approaching definitive proof that Iran wanted to weaponize its program. Now, this is a whole other conversation, but Iran is not. Now, nuclear technology is dual-use technology. Under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is a signature of, every country in the world has a right to nuclear power. This was the Atoms for Peace program, I think it was called, the 1950s, in the beginning of these sort of 1950s and 60s, in the beginning of these global agreements on containing nuclear weapons. So Iran is within its right under that treaty to enrich and have nuclear power. Now, the environmental consequences of it and the safety of it are separate questions, but under the context of that treaty, they have a right, Japan has a right, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, Germany, Ukraine, anywhere has a right to do this. So that's not really in question. And then the question is, you know, and some positions, the position of the right here and the position of Israel has been Iran simply cannot have that technology, period. Now that's not going to happen. They're going to have that technology. I think Iran has definitely had among certain factions of the Iranian leadership, there has been some strategic ambiguity about the nature of their program. Because don't forget, they're thwarting off. If you were Iran in 2003, 2004, and you thought to yourself, okay, there's a ring of U.S. troop presence around us. There's Iraq, there's Afghanistan, troops stationed all throughout the Gulf, and we're in the axis of evil speech. They didn't go after North Korea. that does actually have a weapons program? What's to keep us from going after us? Israel hates us. So there's a reason why Iran would have some ambiguity about their program in terms of a deterrence on them getting invaded. The notion that Iran would launch a preemptive strike is insane, crazy, shows a complete fear-mongering and total misunderstanding of how the Iranian leadership works, which I am no defender of. Do many terrible things, but they're not launching a nuke into Israel or giving one to Hezbollah to launch into Israel to herald the second coming of the Mahdi or whatever other thing you'll hear on Fox News or in some conspiracy journals. That's ridiculous. Or in the Congress for that matter. So the mechanics of this deal are really close, and it would basically mean Iran accepting tight new monitoring of its program, but it would still have some program, and in response there would be a loosening and dropping of sanctions and really allowing Iran to kind of reintegrate into the global system. There's problems on both sides. On Iran, the supreme leader, according to analysts, Ayatollah Khatami, has basically given the permission for Rouhani and the foreign minister Zarif to negotiate, but he hasn't committed to accepting a deal. Because just as there's a hard right in the United States, there's a hard right in Iran that doesn't want to back down to any Western demands, and for that matter, likes this policy of strategic ambiguity about having a weapons program. So inside Iran, you have a very small window for Rouhani and reformists, but also pragmatists who want to make a deal. And that window is closing. So that deal could come through now. The momentum would be on that side, and it could probably happen. But if it doesn't, it will revert back. Now, we know Obama really wants this deal, and you know that Obama saw this a couple weeks ago, came out that he sent a private letter to the supreme leader saying that they should coordinate against ISIS. I'm sure that that's already happening informally through the Kurds. But we know that in Congress and in the Senate, while Democrats were able to fight back Republican and conservative Democrat efforts to undermine this deal last winter, now with the Republicans back in control, that's a really bad sign for this deal. We were talking about people like Menendez and Kirk, Menendez from New Jersey, Democrat, Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois. They're already talking about reintroducing a new sanctions package which would undermine and kill this deal. It also shows Obama as undermined and diminished in the eyes of the Iranian negotiating partners. Now, Obama could, again, through executive action, he could actually lift a lot of these sanctions on his own. And one theory would be if this agreement comes into fruition, the sanctions are lifted in the short term, and you see how well it works, there's a natural momentum to it that could sustain the agreement. But that's not a guarantee. And I would just say that while we watch the Republican Congress for all of the insane things that they're going to try to do over the next couple of years, including things that are, you know, much more immediate to people's lives and very rightly should be focused on, this is probably the preeminent foreign policy world stability issue, or at least certainly one of the next decade or two. You really have the opportunity to produce a lot more stability and progress or continue in a situation which could definitely lead to a truly catastrophic war and military engagement. So that's what's happening with negotiations with Iran. They're resuming again this week in Switzerland. All right. Read a few more IMs, then we'll get to this sound. Oh, my bad. We have a caller.
We do.
All right. Hopefully this will work. You're calling from a 951 area code. Who are you and what are you calling about?
Hey, can you hear me all right?
Can hear you
yes,
great.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Cheney Shop and Duck Hunt Dog. I'm calling in because a lot of you guys keep talking. I wanted to compliment Matt that he's talking about feminism. I think that's very important, and I don't care how many subscribers you lose because I can tell some people.
All right, now we are losing you. Now we are losing you. It seems like you're like fading away from your phone.
Yeah.
That's better.
Here, let me try to call back.
No, stay right there. Where you are right now is good.
Get as close to your mic as get as close. Yeah, just be close to your microphone as possible.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, I was just saying, there's a lot of these people that have this overreaction to anything that they perceive to be a feminine issue, and I just don't get it. I don't understand. You know, the recent thing with the guy's shirt at the, the space thing. I don't understand why people, if someone writes an article that says, the shirt is problematic, I don't have this really negative reaction. I don't, freak out because maybe I don't agree with the article. I don't have to start a hashtag about it. I don't have to post image memes about it. You know what I'm saying?
What's the shirt story? I don't know that story.
The shirt thing was the guy at the guy that landed the that rover on the comet or whatever that thing was.
Oh, the Rosetta Stone thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So he. Yeah. Okay.
In a real khaki shirt, and there was some people that said that the shirt was sexist.
Right.
You know, the thing is that I don't necessarily agree with those people, but I also don't have this really negative reaction that a lot of assholes have, basically.
So you're asking, why do people, why is it anytime there's an issue that involves women or feminism, there's such a total meltdown online, basically?
Yeah. No, I mean, they call people, social justice warriors, because there seem to be the people that always want to have a fight.
Mm. What do you think, Matt? This is your beat.
I mean, something I've noticed.
We all notice it. I mean, yeah. Especially working in this business. But, I mean, what do you think, Matt?
I mean, I agree. I.
But what do you think motivates it? What the caller – I'm sorry, what's your name again? Chaney shot the dog. Okay. Chaney shot the dog would like to know, I guess we see it happens, but why basically? What's the why of the meltdown anytime there's
I had a hard time hearing him. Could you just really quick?
All right. You know what, man? I appreciate the call. I'm going to let you go and then we'll respond to your question because the line is a little choppy.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, man.
I was actually going to cut off again, but then I realized you were making – I couldn't –
Well,
couldn't
first of all, you should thank him because I don't know if you heard it, but he praised your work.
Why, thank you.
But I think what he was saying was basically that why is it that any time there is he brought up the Rosetta Stone shirt guy.
Actually, I was going to talk about that later in the show.
Right. Well, we'll get to that. Yeah. But basically, I think just you'll do the whole story, but just so people know what we're talking about, why don't you tell them whatever. The point is that every time someone writes an article on anything to do with a woman's issue, there is not only disagreement, there's a meltdown. And I guess he was wondering, I guess the point he was making was hey, I could disagree with any number of things, but I don't have to have a tantrum anytime I see something that involves issue.
I agree with it's just a bizarre it's to me from just looking at the most recent things that came up Gamergate and this whole scientific shirt thing. It's literally guys don't like that women's opinions are now seeping into what used to be their space. That's how I look at it.
There's probably, makes sense.
Of course there's always been gamer girls, and of course there's always been women in science, but they are you literally can point them out on make a poster with just the ones that people talk about, whereas there's hundreds of thousands of men in science who people cite, So, I mean, I really do think that's basically what it comes down to. It's a boys club that's no longer becoming a boys club. And you're getting these voices. I mean, like they always say, when someone starts to you always hear the loudest voices when they start to lose. You know, they realize their culture or their industry is no longer catering just to them and catering to their every whim, and they don't like it. It's bothering them that, you know, why can't I wear a shirt with half naked ladies on it on television while I'm representing the scientific community?
Oh, what? No.
I mean, that's literally what it is, though. You know, why? Who is this woman think she is critiquing my video games? She doesn't have the right. She is not a true gamer. I mean, it's the no true Scotsman thing when it comes down to. You know, no.
Oh,
real...
I don't want to hear about that. I'm glad I don't even know what that is. But every time people would – I got a lot of tweets about that with the Sam Harris debacle. But I get what you're saying.
No, but that's what it is. I mean, you know.
But I also think – I mean, I'm sorry, what you
no,
finish
continue,
what you're
continue.
Saying. I guess I also think – see, I think what's really tricky, especially when you're involved in doing work for social justice and reform basically, is you – and again, I used this example a couple of weeks ago, but I think it kind of helps to broaden the scope of these things. So it's not just these sort of things that are really hot or triggering or in the news cycle or whatever. But when they studied Reagan Democrats in the 80s, right? And Reagan Democrats were these people who, you know, it's a self-explanatory term. They were Democrats who voted for Reagan. But a lot of them, they weren't like, you know, high-earning Democrats who maybe just wanted to get a tax cut. These were people who really were going to get – they were going to feel the pinch from all the things Reagan was doing to the social safety net and to the economy. Just like people now who, you know, earn less and vote Republican. And what they found when they studied them was, you know, and these were definitely white people, was that they did actually have a really strong skepticism about business and the corporate sector, but they felt powerless to do anything about it. And they did feel some power over basically people who they perceived as lower than them on the totem pole. And that's, you know, a really negative version of it. But I think what I noticed, because we got a couple of emails about Gamergate. Okay. You're just adjusting the camera?
Yeah.
We got a couple of emails about Gamergate. And I try to, because especially for me, you know, I know, because I'm a total outsider to it. So I think it's funny. It's like, whatever, like, you know, get a life. Like, I'm sorry, you know, that's where I'll go joke wise. Like, go take a run, as I always said. But some people were writing in and you could tell it's like, you know, I guess the point I'm trying to get to is how do you tell somebody that, of course, in a social, economic and political sense, they have a lot of privilege, but they personally and psychologically don't feel any privilege in their lives, right? They feel like they're socially marginalized. They don't have, you know, they don't have that many friends. They don't really have much going on. Maybe they don't have great prospects in today's job market. Maybe they don't have a lot of stuff going on. So I think what is going to – I mean, I think part of it is definitely what you're saying, which is just like, hey, you're privileged in a certain space, and when that privilege gets undermined – there's a reaction to it. And that's definitely a big part of what's happening. But I also think that the other thing that's going on is that there's going to be a way of figuring out the language of talking to people about the privilege they do have, but they actually don't feel an experience in any way that's tangible to them. And that's a very subtle point, but I do think that there's something there that cuts across a whole range of issues that are much bigger than Gamergate.
Oh,
you know, like,
oh, yeah,
like that, these are like the economics.
If this was just about video games,
no, I know, but I'm saying, but it goes
show.
No, of course, but it goes, you know, it goes to people's voting patterns. It goes to people, you know, there's a lot of people, frankly, who, you know, whether it's like a, you know, some isolated kid who has an outlet in video games, or even someone who, frankly, you know, some, you know, generic privileged white dude who's underwater on two mortgages, they don't want to hear about their privilege. They want to hear about how their lives are going to get better. And you do that in a way that talks about everybody's life getting better, and that does implicate some of the privileges they have. But if you just come at them with, here's another thing that you sort of suck about, that's a problematic messaging. So it's a hard – it's a, you know, so these are some of the things that kind of sell. We have one more call. Let me take it, and then we'll – or sorry.
You no, were, I was just going to say, yeah, you know, sorry. Another thing that you know, when speaking to privilege,
yeah,
you know, like in an issue like this where, like, you know, a woman writer will write about this shirt gate thing or whatever it's being called.
Right.
And I'm just changing the camera here. And, you know, they bring it up, and then, you know – other women may come out and say, oh, I don't have a problem with it. And men will cite those women as, see,
well, that's
women,
not your
women,
shield.
Women don't, yeah, yeah, women don't have a problem with it. But you see, the fact that there are women who are speaking out saying, I have a problem with this, that shows that there are women who have a problem with it. I mean, I don't understand this whole, you know, just because we find scattered pieces of, you know, a scattered person here, a scattered person there, scattered pieces of opinions that agree with you, that that somehow invalidates other people. You know, in this case, other women are invalidated. Other women are invalidated because completely separate women have different opinions. Like, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I mean, but that's like a classic, you know, that's the reason why, you know, you're always looking for, you know, frankly, like, you know, and I mean, look, yeah, there's a big market for people who will deliver your message. You know, that's why the, you know, the search for African American Republicans, there's nothing particularly, I mean, I would say you just have the courage of your convictions. If you don't buy something, you disagree with something, say it. But the other, I mean, the other part that's missing in all of this process is really just any kind of basic empathy and curiosity about somebody else's experience. And that's what I find most frustrating. You're calling from a 954 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
This is Russell. I'm calling from Cold Spring, Florida.
How you doing?
I'm doing very good. How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind, man?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk, go back to Iran, if that was okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think that I just wanted to see what your take on it is. Do you think that sanctions are a good way for us to try to get policies on that we may disagree with? I think that if you look at U.S. policy, often we're violating international law and, you know, we aren't being sanctioned. You know, mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you think that there are better ways for us to have negotiations with countries and just sanctioning them like we do in Cuba or other areas.
Well, I mean, I think sanctions are, you know, like the sanctions and policy towards Cuba is just stupid, right? And that has nothing to do with – that's really just comes down to Florida is a pivotal election state and New Jersey, you know, that's politics. There's no substantive policy argument for keeping up the embargo on Cuba. I mean, I guess, okay, and then the other aspect is like that we're hypocritical about international law. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, international relations and all this stuff is – it's about power, right? And it's about the selective application of principles when it comes from, you know, a state perspective. So I wouldn't – you know, there's another question about could you make international institutions more fair and less dominated by certain players – you know, and that might be a way that so there, but then how do you enforce those things, right? Like, that's a whole other question. I think with Iran, you know, the policy, I don't buy it at all in the sense that I don't, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with slapping some things on them, like around what happened in 2009 with the elections and the Green Movement and stuff like that. I don't think there's anything wrong with registering objections. But I think fundamentally the whole policy on Iran and the whole perception of Iran as some kind of, you know, mega terrorist state or something, even though they do fund groups that we would consider terrorists, but like they are a rational player. We probably could have had a deal with them a long time ago. In fact, they tried to reach out to us in 2003.
Yeah, in fact, and also in, I believe it was 2012, they had a conference to have a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region, and Iran was willing to attend, so that wasn't an opportunity that we pursued. I think if we were serious, we'd probably the best option for us was just to try to set up a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region, because as long as Israel also has nuclear weapons, there's always going to be that incentive for Iran to try to pursue and get nuclear weapons, and that's always going to be a threat.
Yeah, I mean, Iran, I mean, that's, you know, that's one of those things that's just like it's, you know, Israel will give up its nuclear weapons when we have like a completely nuclear weapon free world. But and you know, and as you say, so that's the politics. We're not going to participate in that conference because that conference is about Israel disarming, and that's a perfectly legitimate desire for Iran to have. But at the same time, they're playing politics too by advocating that, you know, that conference. And everybody's got their constituencies and everybody's got their people to play to and placate. But the bottom line is that we this deal could really happen, and this deal would have huge benefits.
All right. Thank you. Big Trey, the first time caller. Thank you.
Oh, awesome. Really appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot. All right. We have one more caller. I don't know where Matt is. Matt is like getting a paper or something. All right, he's back. I just want to make sure you're here in case this guy has a question for you. 601 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hi, guys. It's Nate from Texas.
Hey, Nate. How you doing, man?
Good, good. I just wanted to bring up something today. I think it's really important that we remember what's going on in Gaza, not just when there's, you know, active attacks going on, but we have to keep these people in our thoughts. 1.5 million people who are being, you know, starved. They're under siege. A large proportion of them are homeless now. And, you know, just so many deaths of innocent people, innocent children. And their lives are, you know, ongoing punishment. So we have to keep that in mind. And I wanted to mention to you guys, I've texted this before, but Sam has a little trouble pronouncing the name. So I wanted to ask that you guys interview Ali Abunima.
I
can send you a link to his work.
Yeah, I know Ali's work. Yeah, that's possible. I think we covered, you know, I think having Max on covered a lot of the similar bases. I'm not... It's kind of a conversation for another day. I'm not totally sold on all of Ali's work, but we do have I'm familiar, and he is on a list, and I remember you asking that. That his site is Electronic Intifada.
Right, Electronic Intifada, familiar with. And I think he is the premier voice on the issue. I mean, he's really important for people to understand. I'm not saying you have to agree with everything he said, but he has a really unique take on the situation. And he's a really powerful, clear speaker, you know. And about the white privilege thing, you know, what I try to tell Nazis and people like that is, look, it's not about you feeling guilty or giving up something. It's about you having empathy for other people and maybe letting them have the kind of lives that we have. You know,
there's
a
lot more power. Yeah.
Chance.
Yeah. I'm sorry. No, absolutely. No doubt about it.
That is a major thing where people think that white privilege means they're supposed to feel some sort of guilt. You're supposed to, exactly how you said it, Nate, you know, just have empathy and understand why people are in the position they're in, where they're in, and why you're in the position that you're in. It's that simple. It's not about guilt. You said it perfectly.
And we should probably
make everyone's life better.
Exactly.
Right. That's the major point.
And thanks, guys. Y'all have a good day.
Thank you. You too. And there's, you know, there's probably plenty of places across the world, like Congo, as an example, that we should probably be mentioning and thinking about a lot more, not just when they're in the headlines. 518 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Brendan from Schenectady, but I'm getting an echo from the phone.
Is that your full name?
Oh, we hear you good. So if it's not too annoying for you, don't worry about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's pretty rough. I'm hearing the show like 10 seconds ago.
Okay, so call right back.
Yeah, call right back in.
All right, I'll call back.
Okay. All right, let's get to this sound. There's plenty of IMs, but they will be gotten to. So we all know that net neutrality is very much in the news because President Obama finally came out and made a strong call on it. Isn't one of those nifty, I'll do this after the election moves that Democrats seem to be fond of. But at any rate, he came out, pushed it strong, and we'll see. And of course, in response to it, Republicans had a number of tremendously stupid things to say about net neutrality, including Ted Cruz. Matt covered it great last week. calling it the Obamacare of the internet. Senator Al Franken was on CNN talking to Candy Crowley. She read the quote to him, and he debunked it, but he also he framed this issue in a smart way. This is really the essential way of framing net neutrality and how vital it is for the future of the internet moving forward. Let's play that sound.
Last week, I wanted to read you something from an op-ed that Senator Ted Cruz wrote about the issue. Okay. Net neutrality is Obamacare for the internet. It would put the government in charge of determining internet prices, terms of service, and what types of products and services can be delivered, leading to fewer choices, fewer opportunities, and higher prices. Government-regulated utilities invariably destroy innovation and freedom. Your reaction?
He has it completely wrong. He just doesn't understand what this issue is. We've had net neutrality the entire history of the internet. So when he says this is the Obamacare, Obamacare was a government program that fixed something, that changed things. This is about reclassifying something so it stays the same. This would keep things exactly the same that they've been. And the pricing happens by the value of something.
I guess the question is, if you want to keep it exactly the same as it is, it seems like the answer would be, it's not broken, don't fix it. And yet the government's coming to fix it.
It's because these ISPs, which have been getting bigger, and the nature of the internet has changed in that
ISPs,
it's become,
meaning the Comcast, AT&T, Verizon.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The internet service providers have gotten bigger. They essentially have an oligopoly, and they have been talking about a fast lane. They have been talking about charging big, deep-pocketed corporations extra money to go faster,
right,
meaning everyone else goes slower. So that's the change that has been proposed.
Okay, there's two things I love about that clip. Number one, it's always easier, for better or for worse, but it's been very relentlessly documented in behavioral economics and other types of research on how people make decisions and how they respond to change, that getting somebody to get really focused and riled up about preserving and keeping what they already have is an easier sell than offering them something that could be better, single-payer healthcare as an example, not Obamacare, single-payer. But to say this is about you like it today. You like that all sites move at the same speed today. You like that there is entrepreneurial opportunity for you to start a business and not be at a structural disadvantage. You can't go out tomorrow and say, I'm going to start a TV network. The barrier to entry to starting a business online is far, far lower. We know that. That really is one of the indisputable benefits of this medium and of this time, even with all the other problems we have. So that's clear. This is about what already is. The other part that I love, and he could have maybe even been more aggressive about, is this generic fairy tale thing that Ted Cruz says, which is like, well, just the very act of a company being able to offer new products and services is a good thing. Like, it's innovation to rig a market in your favor and then come up with the platinum delivery package, the gold delivery package, the silver delivery package. That's what he means. Sometimes innovation sucks. Sometimes disruption sucks. And in fact, the most disruptive thing that you could do in today's economy is preserve a smart status quo. So kudos to Franken for putting Cruz in his place, and watch that conflation of any time a company can do something, that's innately good. It's not. It may even be innovative, but it's not innately good.
All right, let me get to this story. I didn't want to spend – I really thought this would just be a side story that we could a better half story to mention, but apparently it's taken hold with a lot of people. You got to turn the phone system down.
Sorry. Down.
There we go. So this has taken a life of its own now, hasn't it? People are using Shirtgate and Shirtstorm to call – they're calling it that. I mean, do you believe this, Michael? I mean, it's pretty
– I really don't.
Yeah. So basically, to summarize, last week, the ESA, the European Space Agency, landed a space probe on a comet. First time it's ever been done. And they were getting data and photographs sent back from that space probe to the ESA, and they were sharing it. And it was a historic achievement in the scientific world and humanity. This is crazy. We landed on a comet. Humans have landed on a comet.
That is crazy.
Well, humans have landed a robot type thing on a comet.
That's cool.
And one of these guys who was part of the project called the Rosetta Project was Dr. Matt Taylor. And this would have been just, you know, one of your run-of-the-mill type of interviews, except for the fact that Dr. Matt Taylor was wearing a shirt with half-naked women on them. Now, right there to me, I mean, Michael and I saw the shirt last week when he first went on TV to have this, when they landed on the comet and he had this TV interview, and we laughed at it. It's a tacky shirt.
And it is a sore spot for me because the amount of times I've had to get Sam to take off one of those shirts.
One of those Hawaiian style.
One of those Hawaiian style shirts with naked women on it. It's just, it's frustrating, frankly.
Yes. So we thought it was tacky. We thought it was a dumb thing to do. And a lot of women in the scientific community and writers, for example, Rose Eveleth of The Atlantic, and men too, Chris Plant of I believe he's with the not The Verge, with
I don't know
the other site that's with The Verge.
Quartz?
No, he is with The Verge. I'm sorry, I was thinking of Vox.
Okay.
Their partner sites, yes.
Indeed.
But he is with The Verge.
At The Verge. Okay, go ahead.
They had a problem with this shirt, and they wrote about it. They called it a sexist shirt. They said it was hateful. They said it doesn't help the whole issue of women getting into science, which they're definitely not enough women in the scientific community.
Major issue.
Yes, just like in the tech world and the video game industry. And they criticized the guy for wearing the shirt. Now, I agree with those criticisms to the point where this is a professional setting. Right. He should not have been wearing this shirt at work, period. But then on top of it, to know you're going to do this today and that very likely you will be spoken to, interviewed by the press to wear this shirt on TV, you're then putting yourself in a public sphere where you're most definitely open to critique. Once you put yourself on national television or international television for the world to see, you can't really complain about the actions you do or say while on that medium. You're putting yourself out there. And do I think this guy did it maliciously? Absolutely not. I don't think Dr. Matt Taylor even realized what he was doing, which again speaks to this issue of men and women in this community, where women who are in the scientific community have to deal with this, and the men in this community don't even see that they're like this, that they're doing this. And over the weekend, I looked up so much about how women who are actually not writers, actually women in the scientific field, and their experience. They've written about their experience where they had to go in the lab, and when they were in the lab, they had to be subjected to pictures of porn, scenes from hardcore porn, printed out and posted on bulletin boards for the other male scientists to see and laugh at and look at. And they had to deal with this because they were the one or two women who worked in this lab, and if they said something, they don't want to put themselves out there for saying something. They don't want to have any personal problems with their peers. So they just keep quiet usually because maybe it's not worth it to them. But you know what? I'll tell you, it affects them. It certainly did enough for them to talk about it in their piece. So to get back to this specific issue though. So Matt Taylor, the scientist, went on TV again and he got very emotional. He was crying and he apologized. Now, this brings up the issue of, for those questioning, is calling this shirt hateful and oppressive and hurting women in the field sexist? Is there any validity to that criticism? Is the criticism valid? Is basically what I'm saying. And Matt Taylor's response gives you that answer. And that answer is yes. Because of the scientist, Matt Taylor, did not think it was a valid criticism. If he just sat there and went, you know, I wore the shirt, what's the big effing deal? He wouldn't have went out there and apologized. He wouldn't have went out there and cried on TV because he felt bad. I mean, he obviously felt, wow, I can't believe what I did. I didn't mean to do it, and I feel horrible about it. I don't see what the problem is there. But, see, the people who defend this boys' club, this sexism is okay in these male-dominated industries and these male-dominated fields. The people like MRAs, the people like the Gamergate community, you know, people who just don't like women intruding on their boys' club. They had a problem with this guy going on TV and apologizing. They had a problem with the criticism of his shirt. They had a problem with him crying, actually, because they framed it as, you made this poor man cry. We're talking about a grown man here. If he feels emotional about the issue, no one made him cry. He himself looked into himself and realized, I fucked up. Now let's get to some, like, and then let me, again, just like the men and women who felt this shirt was sexist had the freedom to criticize this shirt that this guy wore in a public sphere, I also agree that those who want to critique the criticism of the shirt have the right to do so. However, one woman I mentioned before, Rose Eveleth, and then Chris Plant, another guy I mentioned before, they haven't received criticism about their criticism. They've received straight-up harassment and hate about this shirt. People telling them to kill themselves. People not talking about this shirt at all. People sending personal attacks to them. And then let's get to some of these attacks I've seen. Some of these critiques of the criticism I've seen. One that was shared a lot was one that is taking images of feminist protesters, feminist activists at protests who are maybe topless, who are, you know, have written stuff on their chest, don't tell us how to dress. You know, the type of things you see at events like Slut Walk that aims to end the slut shaming of women. And they superimpose it next to the guy who's wearing the shirt with the half-naked ladies. And they're asking, what's the difference? Why can you not tell this woman how to dress? And why can you tell this man how to dress? Now, let me address that attack, because that's one of the criticisms I've seen a lot. The point there is, those women are showcasing their bodies, the female body, in an attempt to bring light to an issue. What this guy is objectifying is not his own body, the male body. He's objectifying a body that is not his. He's objectifying the woman's body. If he was a man and he wanted to wear a shirt with half-naked men on it, I would still say it's not smart to wear it on TV, nor to wear it in your place of work. But I guarantee you that would be much less of an issue because he is a man. If he was wearing a V-neck shirt that showed a little bit of his chest, no one would be slut-shaming him because he's a man and it's his own body that he is choosing to wear that shirt. Again, whether you want to wear a V-neck at work, whether you want to wear a V-neck on TV, that's up to debate whether that's the appropriate attire. But in this specific case, women who are protesting, again, we're talking about women who had a protest. These women aren't showing up naked to their place of work. These women are using their body, the female body, whereas this man is using, not his body, a female body. So that criticism, there you go. Debunked. And then there's this criticism that I've
debunked.
Also been seeing a lot of. Debunked. Again, superimposed next to a picture of the guy wearing the shirt. And you know what? I really do feel bad for this guy at this point, that he apologized for it, and the people who are supporting this shirt are plastering his photo everywhere, more so than the criticisms did, I'll tell you that much. And they take the photo of him and they put it next to a children's, as in a girl's children's shirt, that said, boys are stupid, throw rocks at them. Number one, that shirt actually received lots of criticism when that shirt was released. Number two, we're talking about a children's shirt. You want to tell a little girl that that's not a smart shirt to wear? over a grown adult man who can make that decision? Second of all, also, they can't even find in the meme that's being sent around of the photo of the man wearing the half-naked lady shirt and then the boys throw rocks at boys shirt. They couldn't even find one example of a human being actually wearing the shirt. It's just a picture of the shirt. I mean, maybe even children are smart enough to know this is not a good shirt to wear at school. Yeah. Give me a break. And then this one is my particular favorite. I mean, this one comes from the Gamergate world specifically. They take a photo of the scientist from Jurassic Park. And they put him in the shirt with the half-naked women on them.
That's funny. I don't get the point.
And it says, I don't care if you – because they're attacking that his scientific achievement is being overlooked. The caption says, I don't care if you brought dinosaurs back from extinction. Your shirt is sexist and ostracizing.
I have two problems if the scientist from Jurassic Park wore that shirt because bringing dinosaurs back was a problem.
Exactly. That's the point. Oh, I mean, number one, I don't think they realize Jurassic Park is a movie. And number two, have they missed the entire message of the story of Jurassic Park? The whole point, and this works perfectly even to the shirt, the guy wearing the shirt in real life. The whole point of the movie was two scientists. You were too caught up in if you could do it, you didn't stop to think if you should do it. I mean, the man literally was so caught up in getting dinosaurs back to bringing back dinosaurs from extinction, having a place where people could visit dinosaurs, that he even stopped to think of the ramifications of doing so, and his grandchildren were almost eaten by a T-Rex. So yes, actually, if he was wearing this shirt in Jurassic Park, he would have been like, wow, I got to stop and think about this shirt. And maybe that would have even made him stop and think, you know, maybe this whole dinosaur thing isn't such a good idea either.
What an asshole. Like, with all the problems that we have to deal with in the world today, the friggin' Hawaiian naked shirt lady brought dinosaurs back to life. Like, F you, buddy.
And another thing that's being tossed around here to defend this guy is that
– I guess if they threw it on Einstein, it would work.
Yeah.
Which would be a hilarious –
That would be – please throw it on Einstein. Please do it. Yeah. But another thing here is apparently the guy's friend, who's a woman, made the shirt for him. Okay, that's cool. That's fine. If I saw him walking down the street in his own private life wearing that shirt, I probably would have snickered to my friend and said, look at that tacky-ass shirt. And it never would have came up again. There would have been no big hubbub about it. That's great that a woman friend of his made that shirt for him. That's not the point. The point is he wore that shirt at work when he was representing the scientific community globally. I mean, it's that simple. If you can't understand that, and again, I believe this guy had no malicious intent, which actually, again, speaks to the problem in this community where they don't even realize that wearing this shirt would have been a bad idea.
I also just think
that women in their community, their very own peers, would be hurt and offended by this shirt. Unbelievable. Just the fact we're even talking about it is ridiculous. Again, just like with Gamergate, though, until this world, you know, until this small thing grew and grew into a thing that actually became had real world ramifications, where women are being harassed and women are getting death threats and women are feeling ostracized and these things are happening. You know, that's when we do have to talk about it. That's when it's not just about a shirt. That's not when it's just about a video game.
We are going to go to the fun half. We have one caller on the line. I'm going to save you from Matt. We have tons of IMs. Matt will get to all of them. Folks, you can become and should become a member today of the Majority Report by going to
jointhemajorityreport.com.
Jointhemajorityreport.com or
did you really majority.
No, I was hoping you'd jump.
Oh, okay. Majority.fm and clicking become a member. You can also support this show by buying all of your junk through Amazon through our Amazon link. You could find that link at majorityreportkickback.com. And you see no difference in the prices. It's just like going to Amazon.com, except when you go to MajorityReport.com, Amazon is forced to share their profit, their cut of the pie, their piece of the pie with us. So it's not a lot, but it's a little bit, and it does help. You could also support this show by
holiday season coming up.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. By all your Hanukkah, Christmas, anything, whatever.
If you're
you
using Amazon, give us a cut. Let us wet our beaks a little bit. After all, we're not communists.
Yes. Give us a little bit of a gift too. Yes. A stocking stuffer, if you will. Buy fair trade coffee and chocolates from justcoffee.coop and use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your entire order. It's a win-win-win if you ask us here at the Majority Report. Also, you can support the show by liking us on Facebook, facebook.com/majorityreport. You can like us on you can follow us on Twitter at @MajorityFM. Subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/SamCedar, and the live page, which shows the live stream like right now as it's happening live, at youtube.com/MajorityReportLive. Donate your account. We really need people to re-donate their accounts. We had a lot more people who donated their Facebook and Twitter account. Basically, what that means is you connect your Facebook or Twitter account to donate your account, and then once a day, we will share a story from the show or today's podcast with your friends and followers on Twitter and Facebook. But sometimes Facebook and Twitter refresh their permissions, which means you have to redo that with all the different apps you connect your Facebook or Twitter to. You got to do that with Donate Your Account. A lot of people who originally were doing it with us just disappeared. So donateyouraccount.com, go there, sign in with Twitter or Facebook or both, and help
write
us out.
Write a review
there
of us on iTunes. That really helps get more eyeballs on the Majority Report. Pick a clip or a podcast, but pick a YouTube clip. Go on Facebook, go on Twitter, start an argument. Say,
grab,
this is what I think.
Grab Sam Cedar's feelings on Gamergate and
I think we've exhausted that argument, but do that. Do anything.
They did.
It's
make
actually
a video
in
about
all
them.
In all. It doesn't even need to be an argument. It could just be an interesting way because you know we're covering a lot of things that isn't just horse race stuff. The stuff that actually is, pretty important for people's lives. So share it, have a debate, download the app. It's free.
Support a show that doesn't do a lot of the horse race stuff. I mean, it's that simple. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about Hillary 2016.
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
Hillary Clinton going to Iowa in 3 weeks. Good move, bad move.
Hillary Clinton drank a cup of coffee this morning from a bodega.
Yeah. Hispanic voters. This is important in the Democratic See, we can do it, but we choose not to always do it. All right, folks, we'll be right back in the fun half of the program.
Oh, boy.